Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 Starcast. Happy New Year and welcome back to the Starcast for the week of January 4th, 2025. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer, and with me is my co-host, Mike Lewinsky. Happy New Year, Mike.
Happy New Year, Jay. It's great to be back.
Yep, it sure is. And we're looking forward to a nice 2026. Mike, what's our space weather looking like over the next couple days?
Well, Jay, we are keeping an eye on sunspot 4325, which has a beta gamma magnetic field, which poses a threat of M-class solar flares. So it's down, heading away from us, but still in the active region. We do have a C6 flare that went off on January 1st that may arrive today and spark a minor G1 geomagnetic storm, really, unless you're up in the very northern latitudes. It's unlikely to be visible here given the full moon. But officially, our forecast says we have a 50% chance of an M-class flare over the next 24, 48 hours. And a 10% chance of an X-class flare over the next 2 days. For geomagnetic storms, our probability here at mid-latitudes is active conditions at 40%, minor storm would be 25%, and a mere 5% chance of a severe storm. Whereas up at high latitudes, that chance of a severe storm is as high as 65% today, dropping down to 35% chance tomorrow. So the full moon is really kind of our biggest obstacle to seeing northern lights here at the lower latitudes right now. So what's up in space, happening in the space this week, Jay?
So we're starting off the new year with a rare triple alignment. Last Friday, of course, was the first full moon of the year, sometimes called the Wolf Moon, and it was a supermoon. And it also coincides with the Earth's closest approach to the sun, an event called the perihelion. And that means that the Earth, Moon, and Sun were all unusually close and aligned as the new year begins. This triple event, the closest moon, the full moon, and the closest sun, is rare. The last time that this actually happened was back in 1912. And some people actually blamed the calving of the iceberg that sunk the Titanic on that alignment and the gravitational pull that would cause. But that, is, of course, is totally speculation. And the second brightest thing in the night sky after the moon is still Jupiter. And so you can see it this week grouped with the waning gibbous moon and the Gemini stars, Castor and Pollux. So if you look up and the brightest thing next to the moon is the planet Jupiter. So, Mike, what do we have for us in space news for the new year?
Hey, Jay, before I jump into that, I just want to comment. I was out last night for that Wolf Moon, using my C-Star to record it just as it emerged over the edge of Crestone Peak. It was a beautiful sight. Made for a nice video. I also watched as Jupiter rose a little bit to the south of that, and I was filming that with the C-Star and captured, you know, the rise of the Jovian moons as they were coming over the mountain. So that's always kind of a cool thing to watch as they come popping out one at a time. Also, you know, before we leave night sky happenings, I think we should give readers a heads up now that the first and lunar eclipse, total lunar eclipse, the only total lunar eclipse this year is happening on March 3rd. So that's just 2 months away. Folks might want to make plans. If you're going to go somewhere to watch it, make your reservation now. Here in the western United States, in New Mexico, Colorado, the moon will be setting that morning of March 3rd while still eclipsed, although it will no longer be in totality. And this is, I believe, the last total lunar eclipse we're going to see until 2029. So hopefully we're going to have good weather for that.
And yeah, oh yeah, lunar eclipse. Okay, yeah.
So
I was thinking solar eclipse, and I was wait a minute, Mike.
yeah, nope.
Okay, yeah. So okay, yeah, we'll keep an eye out for that in March, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that as that day comes closer.
Yes. So in space news, 2026 is looking like it's going to be a landmark year of lunar exploration, starting with the return of human flights to the moon and also a surge in robotic missions from both private companies and international powers. First up, leading the charge is NASA's Artemis II mission, which is currently scheduled to launch in February. This 10-day mission will take a crew of three Americans and one Canadian to the moon for the first time in over 50 years. While the crew will not land, they're going to execute a flyby, zipping past the moon and performing a U-turn behind it before returning to Earth. Mission Commander Reid Wiseman notes that the crew will have a unique opportunity to visually survey large areas of the lunar far side that were missed by the Apollo astronauts. These observations are expected to provide vital data for geologists and experts who are selecting future landing sites for the Artemis III program, which will finally put boots back on the lunar surface. Following the human crew, there's a fleet of commercial robotic landers that are preparing to launch, signaling a major shift toward private sector lunar access. Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos's aerospace company, plans to launch a prototype of its Blue Moon lander early in the year. The demo vehicle will stand 26 feet or 8 meters tall, taller than the Apollo lunar modules, with the final crewed version expected to be nearly double that height. Two other companies, Astrobotic Technology and Intuitive Machines, are targeting 2026 for return missions that will carry scientific payloads to the lunar surface. And Firefly Aerospace is setting its sights on a technically challenging landing on the moon's far side. Now, on the international front, China is advancing its lunar ambitions with the mission targeting the moon's south polar region. That mission aims to deploy both a rover and a hopper, or a spacecraft designed to jump into permanently shadowed craters. Their primary objective is the search for water ice, which is a critical resource for future sustained lunar exploration. Now, some say that we have already explored the moon and should be looking on to Mars, kind of a been there, done that attitude. But the lunar environment still holds many questions and opportunities for the near future. And I think also it's likely that we're going to use the moon as a jump point to get to Mars. So today we're going to take a look at just how challenging the lunar environment is and how we might inhabit a moon base or even a colony, and why the race to the moon is so important. Jay, why is the moon so difficult?
Well, to the naked eye, the moon is kind of a serene silver companion, and it's big in our night sky, and we're familiar with it. But to a spacecraft engineer or a mission planner, it is a hellscape of thermal extremes, razor-sharp shrapnel, and lethal radiation. As we stand on the precipice of a new era of solar exploration in 2026, it is vital to understand that returning to the moon is exponentially harder than history makes it look. I mean, when we look back at the Apollo missions back in the 1970s, they almost made that seem easy over that period of a few years. And I think that we, as a collective humanity, we had kind of a different, more optimistic view of these things, and it made it actually look easier than it actually was. And so we've actually had quite a few spacecraft fail recently in trying to land on the moon. We've had, one or two lunar landers that have basically tipped over, and then we've had a couple that have augured in, and so just landing on the moon isn't as easy as you might think. And before humans can even inhabit the moon, our machines have to be able to survive it. I mean, And it's a tough environment for any machine. And so it is hostile to delicate electronics and mechanical systems in ways that are difficult to simulate here on Earth. First of all, is what we think of as the lunar dust or regolith is actually not like beach sand. It's because there's no wind or water to erode it or atmosphere to melt micrometeorites. Every particle is a jagged shard of glass. And sometimes this is kind of like iron glass, like from meteorites. And it is electrostatically charged by solar radiation, meaning that it clings to everything. Solar panels, glass camera lenses, and spacesuits. It's an engineer's nightmare. This dust can destroy seals and bearings. And during the Apollo missions, it wore right through the outer layers of the spacesuits in days. And it was actually endangering some of the astronauts during those missions. And for a permanent base, dust mitigation is a tier one engineering crisis. Not only for how it affects machinery, is if the dust gets into the atmosphere, controlled atmosphere within the spacecraft. Not only can it wreak havoc on the electronics, it can wreak havoc on the astronauts' lungs. Another huge challenge is just the temperature. While we think on Earth, we're fairly temperate, and things go between freezing and boiling, and even electronics don't operate well outside of those those temperature parameters. Once we get below freezing or above boiling, our electronics tend to not to work so well. And so the moon lacks an atmosphere to distribute heat. So a spacecraft can have boiling temperatures on one side of the spacecraft facing the sun. Of 250 degrees Fahrenheit and the sunlight, and then on the other side of the same spacecraft, just a few millimeters away, it can be minus 130 degrees centigrade or minus 208 degrees Fahrenheit. So this is not only just on a spacecraft sitting on the moon in the sunlight. Another huge problem is the shadow problem. And so, in the permanently shadowed craters of the South Pole of the Moon, the target for Artemis mission and the Chinese, is the temperatures can drop to basically 100 minus 414 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 248 degrees centigrade. Electronics standard to Earth freeze instantly, lubricants shatter. Robots like the upcoming Viper or its successors will actually require nuclear heating or advanced battery loops just to wake up in the morning. So, in a lot of these cases, these spacecraft are just going to have to carry along a source of heat, which is usually, basically uranium. And so they will be using nuclear power just to even keep heated up so they can keep operating. And so that's another challenge, is the thermal challenges. Finally, there's the gravity paradox. And beyond temperatures and dust, the physics of arrival is a unique hurdle. So you would think that landing in 1/6 gravity would be easier, but it actually presents a treacherous paradox. While the spacecraft's weight drops drastically, so it's basically going to be 1/6 of its weight, its internal mass remains identical to Earth's. And so all the momentum and things associated with internal mass will be the same. So it requires that the engines throttle down with extreme precision to prevent a floaty vehicle from bouncing off the surface or tipping over like a top on touchdown. And so this has actually happened in 3 cases in the last couple of years, where we've got landers to the moon and they touch down and they bounce or they tip over and they basically become useless and a loss. And so that's been into mission for several spacecraft over the next year. And I don't know if our listeners remember the computer game Lunar Lander, but leave it to say that it's a lot easier to crash than successfully land in the game. And the game, it would probably be quite a bit substantially easier than actually doing it on the moon. So, Mike, why don't you talk a little bit about some of the challenges that we would face as humans on the moon?
Sure, Jay. Building a colony implies comfort, but a lunar base will just be a survival bunker. The primary enemy of a human crew is not just the vacuum of space, but the radiation that sleets down constantly. So on Earth, our magnetic field protects us from most of the radiation of space, but on the moon, astronauts will be exposed to galactic cosmic rays and solar particle events. And I just want to, at this point, kind of give a shout out to the Apple TV series For All Mankind. I understand that it is going to see season 5 released sometime this year, along with a spin-off show called Star City. And they do show one of these solar particle events on the moon that imperils the astronauts who are out doing work on, and have not a lot of time to seek shelter. And it's a great series. I just highly recommend it. So, what is the solution here? We can't just live in a tin can on the surface. A long-term habitat is going to be buried using the Earth, using the lunar surface itself as part of the shield. So, current plans involve an in situ research resource utilization. So, we would use 3D printers to sinter lunar dust into thick protective shells. Or we could inflate habitats inside of ancient lava tubes where hundreds of feet of rock provide natural shielding. How much radiation is there on the moon? There was a study published in 2020 showing that astronauts on the surface of the moon would be exposed to about 60 microsieverts of radiation per hour. By comparison, that's about 200 times what we get on the Earth's surface. So, pretty substantial increase. And when you go on a transatlantic passenger flight, you'll get about 5 to 10 times more than that 60 microsieverts. But of course, that's a short duration one-off. You're flying for 18 hours, 20 hours, once or twice a year, whereas we expect, astronauts could be exposed to those doses on a daily basis. And for much longer periods of time. So, building habitats that protect our bodies is going to be absolutely essential for any long-term lunar habitation. We also have a bottleneck with power. A lunar day is 14 Earth days long, followed by 14 Earth days of absolute darkness and the freezing cold that you mentioned before. During the night shift of 14 days, the base will need massive energy storage to keep from freezing. Solar panels are going to be useless for 2 weeks at a time. So, this really necessitates nuclear fission power or small reactors to keep the life support running when the sun is gone. Beyond the engineering, there is also the psychological toll on the human being. There's a break-off phenomenon in a psychological shift of seeing the Earth as a marble in the sky, combined with confinement in a buried, windowless bunker that really poses quite severe mental health risks for long-term habitation. So we have not just, physical demands, but psychological demands that really need to be accommodated in one form or another, if we're going to send people to the moon for any extended period of time. So, Jay, tell us, why are we going to race to the moon?
Okay, yeah, before I get into that, I was just gonna comment on that this long periods of darkness, and for example, here on Earth we have researchers that are at the South Pole Station in Antarctica, and they experience pretty much the same phenomena in that they will be in the cold and the dark for an extended period of time. And one of the things that that the station, the South Polar Station, is that that would be a kind of a really good simulation of what maybe a lunar base inside of a lava tube would be. And they do have severe mental issues a lot of times in the South Polar region, and they have learned to do some psychological things that actually help people survive that period, and including light therapy, where they have rooms that have specific ultraviolet lights that simulate daylight, and that is one of the things that they do to mitigate some of that psychological impact. So, why go to the moon? If it's so dangerous, why are the US, China, India, and private corporations rushing back? Why is the race to the moon is no longer just about flags and footprints? It's about money, about the economic and strategic future of humanity. If we talk about being off of Earth and in the solar system, the oil of the solar system, if you will, is water ice. And on the moon, we have evidence that the poles contain water ice. Water is heavy and expensive to launch from the Earth. And basically, it cost $1.2 million per ton if we were to launch water to the moon, or to just get it out of the gravity well of Earth. And that's not economically feasible. And it's not really a good idea to just take water away from the Earth. We need it all we can get here. So if we can mine it on the moon, we can split it into hydrogen and oxygen and turn it into rocket fuel and energy. And then that becomes basically the moon can become a gas station or a stopping point, a depot for spacecraft that are going to launch to Mars. So then a spacecraft could launch from Earth with practically empty tanks, or empty their tanks with the launch, and then refuel in lunar orbit using moon mine fuel, and then travel to Mars or the asteroid belt at a fraction of the cost. And so that's one of the huge important things if we were going to basically turn the moon into a gas station. And then also, as hard as and difficult as the moon is, it is easier than Mars. Mars is 6 months away in the most optimistic possible orbit and fastest possible method, and whereas the moon is only 3 days away. And so if a life support system fails on the moon, rescue is at least plausible and probably possible. On Mars, with a 6 month turnaround, and despite the movie The Martian, is that if you have a life support system failure, it's a death sentence. So we must perfect our habitation technologies, closed loop water recycling, radiation proofing, building under the in lava tubes, and doing atmospheric reconstruction and generating an atmosphere, being able to maintain an inflated environment, or maybe being able to, like we said, center regolith, and which is also similar on Mars. Martian soil is also has a large component of micrometeorites as well, and so. These can all be kind of test cased here on the moon, or beta tested before we make the leap to Mars. And then finally, kind of humans being humans, is that it is a strategic high ground. There's a geopolitical reality. The Treaty of Outer Space is actually pretty vague on mining rights at this time. Originally, they said that the moon was going to be preserved for scientific research, and that the space treaty kind of has big loopholes as what is the difference between scientific research and mining for profit? So the first nation to set up infrastructure at the prime peaks of eternal light, the areas on the poles that receive near constant solar power, that's the prime real estate within the solar system, and whoever controls that real estate will effectively control the most valuable real estate in the solar system. So those are the reasons for going there. So let's kind of summarize that up. And the moon is not as welcoming as you would think. Spacecraft must battle electric dust and abrasive dust, thermal extremes, and deal with the gravity. Humans must live underground or under deep shields to avoid radiation sickness. And of course, the prize is energy and a strategic foothold. Any other thoughts on this, Mike?
Jay, just going to include a link in our show notes to a solar center project that was run in the Egyptian desert. We say center, and what does that mean exactly? This solar center was made using some old plasma TV lens covers and a couple solar panels to run a 3D printer. And this man, Marcus Kayser, went out there and built this device and then took sand and, using just the power of the sun, made a bowl out of glass. And so, sintering, that's something that we could readily do using the power of the sun there on the moon. You just basically creating a giant magnifying glass to heat that regolith up to the melting point. And then, obviously we need the nozzles to direct where it flows as we start to build structures. So I think these pictures of the solar center, he used to have a video on there, maybe he still does. It's a very neat process, just to be able to go out and start making things out of regolith. So we'll include that in our show notes.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I probably kind of glazed over a little bit, is that when when it's on the sunny side of the moon, or the daytime on the moon, that actually with solar panels and solar concentrators, we have an abundance of energy. There's more energy than we could possibly use, and so we could put that solar energy on the day side of the moon to use doing those things like sintering and welding, and actually utilize that energy. So energy is not the the game killer on building on the moon. It's actually water, and if you have water, you can make concrete too, and so you can make cement, and then that can not only sintering, but you could actually make lunar concrete. So that's pretty much why we say the moon is a little bit more difficult than it seems, and we're kind of looking forward to this year where we're going to do a lot of lunar exploration. And so that's one of the things to look forward here in 2026. And we want to thank all of our listeners for checking out the podcast and rejoining us here in the new year. Please be sure to comment, like, and subscribe, and let us know what you'd like to hear more about. And you can also check out our individual websites. Mike's is wildernessvagabonds.com, and mine is skylapser.com. And if you'd like to help us out, you can always buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/skylapser. And so I think we were up to a demi tasse of espresso so far. The intro music for the podcast is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library and from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory. This is Jay Schaefer and
Mike Lewinsky
wishing you all a happy new year and clear skies.